Right.
Are you?
One thing, the presence of the instrument. That'll come, that takes it over.
You can go below that, Clyde. You can say the material universe, past, present, and future, is whatever it was that paradise gave forth with in the dawn of eternity, in which we know as space potency.
Well, what I said was something I just remembered.
Bill, let's take
page 64, Bill.
Excuse me. Let's take the difference between a material world. Let's take the difference between a Mirage world and an architectural sphere on salvage.
Well, they've all got the same 100 elements in them.
Well, they're all the same in the core, but yeah, the only difference is the outside.
Yeah, that's right. Let's see. Salvington is a material sphere. There's an awful lot of spiritual stuff on the surface of it.
Sure.
Now, if we had such structures here on this planet, they could be here. We'd never know the difference. Because they're not real to us.
Now, Clyde can appreciate that because he's a geologist.
First thing to move page 64.
What's that?
First thing. Now, to me, that means that to the instrument, it has a. To him, it is.
The first sentence on page 64?
The first sentence on the page.
Oh.
Under the presence.
The physical presence of the infinite is the reality of the material universe, correct? So how does the infinite reveal himself physically first as the Isle of Paradise? And then the whole physical universe, past, present, future, emanates from paradise. If we assume a cosmos infinite, some illimitable cosmos on beyond the master universe, or here, you got a whole bunch of quotes right in here on the 21st appendix. Bunch of paraphrases of what the book says. The master architects are presumed to perceive the relationship of the master universe to something external and larger. If a cosmos infinite is assumed, if there is some endless cosmos external to the master universe, the master universe provides a very suitable experiential foundation for the formation of the second experiential trinity, but its function implies something much larger than this universe. The fact of the existence of co-absolute reality implies the existence of something outside the master universe, onto which experientials can be projected. The full expression of the infinite will require an infinite area. This must be an unlimited domain on beyond the outer margins of the master universe. The outgoing expression of the first source and center may continue on forever, on outward into absolute infinity. It is impossible to limit the absolute cosmos in concept. Man cannot understand this because man is a finite creature in an infinite cosmos. It's that whole series of quotes, Clyde, that suggests to me that the darn thing really doesn't have any end.
Well,
when they speak of the first source and center going on out into absolute infinity, golly, there's no qualifiers in that. Absolute infinity.
What connotation do they put to the circle of eternity, if you use the law? To them, not to me, I know I can't comprehend. What could that come? That is not compatible with those things.
Well, it's not incompatible. It's not incompatible.
We are led to believe, and to me it is compatible, that those things spiritual find their source and destiny. Those things material find their source and destiny. Here are the facts. I mean, source and destiny. Is used quite often. Source and destiny.
Well, let's try one on you here. On the whereabouts of the thought adjuster. I got me one here that I think. You want to turn back, Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
All right, here's the fourth category of the classification of thought adjusters. Vanished adjusters. Here occurs a break in our efforts to follow the careers of the mystery monitors. There is a fourth stage of service about which we are not sure. The Melchizedeks teach that the fourth stage adjusters are on detached assignments, roaming the universe of universes. The solitary messengers are inclined to believe that they are at one with the first source and center, enjoying a period of refreshing association with the Father himself. And it is entirely possible that an adjuster could be roaming the master universe simultaneously with being at one with the omnipresent Father. Clyde, your whole concept has got one possible fallacy in it. You have located God only on paradise, and I think you might also locate him at peripheral infinity. So that as we move out into the infinite remoteness of the outer vastness of the endlessness of all, how do you know we aren't moving toward God? Because if God is at the center, he must also be at the peripheral. He encompasses both.
That might be an aspect of God at will, trying to comprehend.
Try locating him both centrally and peripherally. And then you have your turning back. See, we're trying to put concepts into our minds that we don't have the capacity for. This is like a two-dimensional creature trying to comprehend a third-dimensional creature.
How you like that ant climbing up that end of the circle?
Yeah.
I don't think you'd
you know, something,
there's a
book you folks ought to see if you can get. It's, it must be out of print long since, but if you ever can get flat land. You do? Okay, give it to Goodman to read. It'll help.
Who's the author of flat land?
It's written by a mathematician.
Oh, no, I had
ordered
it.
Was it out of print?
I don't know that it was out of print, but they had to get it from the publisher, I think, somebody.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had to order it and waited on it a long while. It's a busy book.
Yeah,
never busy.
Flat
land.
It's a tremendous book to read to expand your concept. It describes an imaginary two-dimensional country, flatland. And it sets up a little society, you know, triangles, circles, squares, and whatnot. And the whole purpose is to show how difficult it is for a two-dimensional object to understand a three-dimensional object. You see, in flatland, they have north, south, east, west, up, and down. Because flatland sits at an angle. And when you go north, you go up. And when you go south, you go down. And you go east and west. So they have all these concepts. But when the sphere tries to explain to the triangle that you can go up without going north, he says, this is crazy. And the experience which the triangle has with the sphere is very interesting. Because when the sphere becomes tangent with flat land, he sees a spot, then a circle, that grows until the diameter of the sphere passes through flat land. And then little by little, the circle narrows as the sphere is passing through until there's a little spot and then the sphere is gone. It's a little fantasy written by a mathematician to try to help us understand a possible fourth dimension by showing how difficult it would be for a two-dimensional being to comprehend three dimensions. You know something this group might be interested in? This little script I wrote about relativity. Suppose they would? While we're on this subject, there's I drafted a quickie to the space levels. This to you and we'll kick it around. This is a footnote to my third appendix. I captioned it, Paradoxes in Cosmologies. The informed reader cannot help but be impressed by a very significant omission in the papers. This omission concerns their studied ignoring of the entire concept of relativity. The authors of the papers carefully present the geography of the master universe in terms of Newtonian concepts that have long since broken down when applied to the larger astronomic universe. This is such an obvious and such a deliberate act that there must be some very good reason behind it. We can perceive two possible reasons for this avoidance of any mention of the concepts of relativity. A. Comprehensibility. The papers are written to be read by the general reader. Even so, portions of them are hard enough to understand. If they are to make a general appeal, then their concepts must be put in language, not mathematical symbols. B. Fallacy. Could it possibly be that Newton's concepts contain less fallacy than Einstein's? Could the choice of the Newtonian conception represent a deliberate choice of the lesser of two distortions? And of course, there's always the possibility that both of these reasons may have contributed to the choice to avoid any mention of relativity in the papers. And there is the further possibility that neither reason applies. It is the writer's personal opinion that the two reasons cited above explain why no mention of relativity is to be found in the papers. In other words, first, it's incomprehensible, really, to the general reader, and second, it's got more wrong with it than Newton has. Could it be that any comprehensible presentation of cosmography is going to involve distortion of fact, and that the Newtonian presentation results in a lesser distortion than a presentation in terms of relativity? Suppose that we briefly examine the successive cosmographies that Occidental civilizations have devised and consider the distortions of fact which they encompassed and which they successfully rationalized. Including the concepts presented in the papers, there seem to have been four major cosmographies: geocentric, heliocentric, non-centric, and paradise-centric. Stated otherwise, man's cosmographies have been devised first as centered around our world, second, as centered around our sun, third, as having no center, and fourth, as centering around the motionless Isle of Paradise. Let us examine these four cosmographical conceptions. The geographic cosmography. From the perspective of man's senses, this is the most delightfully simple and satisfying way to look at things. The earth is motionless, and everything swings around it. We still say that the sun rises and sets. To the discerning thinker, however, the movements of the planets in the solar system presents a complexity of motion that requires major rationalizations. In other words, as you'd see this planet, it seems to be moving this way, and as our Earth swings in orbit, suddenly the planet reverses itself, begins backtracking, because we're moving in the opposite direction. Formerly, we were moving with it. Such rationalizations were successfully made. It was possible to offer a logical explanation as to why a planet would seemingly reverse its motion in the night sky. But then we've always been able to rationalize. Before oxygen was identified as the supporter of combustion, the substance phlogiston was supposed to be a property of all combustibles, and the loss of weight in burning was good evidence that the phlogiston had been used up. This you found in textbooks on physics. Go back 150 years and you've got it. The heliocentric cosmography. It was hard for the mind to accept the fact that the Earth is not stationary, that the rising of the sun is an illusion produced by the rotation of the Earth. And at first this conception was beset with a multitude of unexplained irregularities. Planetary orbits were first conceived as circles, but the planets refused to conform. And much rationalizing, much phlogiston was required to account for unaccountable differences. Finally, the concept of ellipses replaced circles, and the solar system became comprehensible as a simple system where the outpull of motion is in balance with the in-pull of the sun's gravity, and the planets swing in regular elliptical orbits around the sun. The non-centric cosmography. But the sun, our sun, is not the center of things. It too swings in orbit, and the papers discuss the six simultaneous directions of motion which our sun, our solar system, presently follows. The impossibility of scientifically deducing the motionless Isle of Paradise makes the devising of a non-centric cosmography inescapable. Relativity assumes no real center of the time-space continuum, and perhaps this is the prime fallacy that makes it completely unacceptable to the authors of the papers. It is non-centric. It is possible that relativity also contains its traces of phlogiston, and that it may tend to break down in the farther reaches of the master universe. So far, apparently only one scientist has challenged Einstein, Dr. Franz Zwicky, professor of astrophysics at California Institute of Technology, submits that relativity tends to break down when applied to very great astronomic distances distances of 5 million light years or more. His evidence is based on the seeming failure of gravity to interact. The papers do point out that space can finally neutralize linear gravity. Dr. Zwicky's contentions came to the writer's attention in the January 5, 1959 issue of Newsweek, page 62. The paradise-centric cosmography. The cosmography presented in the papers is that of a creation that does have a center, and wherein absolute motion, motion in relation to this center, can take place. The clockwise, counterclockwise processional of the space levels is absolute motion. Motion in relation to something that is completely motionless, the stationary Isle of Paradise. All other motion of physical bodies in space level, in the space levels is relative motion. It may be that in the largest sense, the Newtonian concept of a universe with a center offers less distortion of fact than the Einsteinian concept of no center. I felt for a long time that sometime something ought to be written as to why these papers so studiedly ignore relativity. And the whole concept of the universe is presented in Newtonian terms. And I think the reason for it is, one, Newton's terms are hard enough to understand, and two, Einstein's got more wrong with it than Newton has when you apply it to the total cosmos.
He extended it in relation to our Earth, but not into relation to the entire
right.
universe.
That's right.
Where Newton dealt with the entire...
Right. Newton's was basically heliocentric. It assumed the center, and the sun was the center. Einstein just assumes there is no center. And he can't possibly assume a center because he can't find one. Paradise is too far away. Now, Zwicky says that Einstein breaks down because in outer space, or in space, in remote space, which is outer space, these galaxies should cluster, and they don't. He finds an evenness of distribution. And I think the reason for that is, you see, he's assuming that gravity never gives out. And there's an answer to that, I think. Space eventually conquers linear gravitation because of the presence therein of anti-gravity influences of numerous supermaterial forces which operate to neutralize gravity action and all responses thereto. See, I think that's what he's... these galaxies are far enough apart so that they don't cluster. The effects of local gravity are absolutely damped out so that it's dead. It's killed off. It's like you take a half and a half and a half. Well, eventually they take what's left in the remainder and sweep it under the carpet so that you don't have this final trace.
Well, the gravity they were talking about the other day, gravity.
It's linear gravity.
Yes, but it has not, it isn't the same, and I said that at primary, you know, there's space and there really isn't a gravity, and that's when he has this thing tumbling. Is that the same gravity that thing is linear?
Yes, that's linear gravity.
But he leaves that when he goes out further, and
yeah.
That's
correct. He's far enough above the Earth so that the effect isn't much.
Yes, well, that would pertain to the same as you were talking about the other.
Yeah. That's not paradise gravity.
No, I know.
Well, this has been an odd afternoon. We talked about the cult, gravity, the infinite, the cosmos infinite, relativity, celestial artisan, language limitations, concept limitations. In short, it's been a kind of a Hungarian goulash of an afternoon, hasn't it?
We haven't discussed the rock and roll or the twist yet.
I come on with many things in reading them. I just can't. I think, well, I, it must be the time. I just don't think I'll ever be able to understand.
Well, even so, try. Because it's fun to know. Sure.
Well, I think every time
I learn
something.
I have a feeling that all of this information, I think, helps us understand God and His plans. I recall one English teacher many years ago who was sort of aghast at the size of this book. And she said, why can't we just take the let's say the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount and call it a day. Why bother with all this? I said, all right, I'll make you a deal. I said, I want to just appreciate the beauty of English and not bother with grammar or spelling or word order or anything like that. I just want to enjoy the language. She says, I get the point. If you want to just feel good about God, well, you just say, well, God loves me and I love God. That's that. But to me, this is the beginning of our efforts to understand God. Look, the story of our world is the story of the outworking of God's purpose in the largest sense of that word. Because God's purpose also involves a recognition and an adjustment for all of the purposes of all of the free will creatures involved in any given situation. And I think in the larger sense makes allowance for this. I don't think the happenings of this world are too contrary to God's purpose in the larger sense of that.
Do you think the book would lose much of its traction if we felt we were comprehending it all?
Sure. You could reduce this book down to three words. You just bind it all up and have one sheet of paper in there. You just have three words on that one sheet of paper. Say, here's your religion. God is love. That's a wonderfully satisfying statement. But let's talk some more about this being, see? Is he only love? No. No, there are other aspects. Well, let's talk about these. And of course, now you're off and running. Now the question is, where do you stop? Once you go beyond some such statement as that, God is the Father, God is love, God is Spirit. Those are the three flat statements Jesus made about God. And the only three you need. So you could write the Urantia book in 9 words. But it would leave you wanting, wouldn't it?
natural good. Everything I've learned is
intriguing.
It inspires you to learn something else.
That's right. That's right.
And if it wasn't that way, it wouldn't be worth its toll.
That's right.
You start in papers and then reduce it to paragraphs and then reduce it to individual sentences. Huh? I mean, that's... I'm finding out that this is true. I mean, your meat is very important in one sentence, whereas prior to it, it might not be. It might be a whole paragraph. And yet,
sure.
You can then reduce it even further.
Listen, I think what they want us to do is this. They want us to feel in our souls that God is love. And to get that impact, this goes beyond mind. No mind ever comprehended God's love. The human heart, the human soul can feel the impact. It's an experiential thing. It's not an intellectual thing. Given that, then let's get mind in harness so that mind can intelligently cooperate with spirit. And to do this, you have got to have some understanding of what God is up to in time and space. And now you're dealing with the evolution of local universes, the evolution of life on the planet, the interaction of many, many variables that produce results. You're up against the problems of good and evil and the adjustment thereto. And you need to know planetary history, human history, cosmic history. You've got to understand, however dimly, what's going on. And then you know when to count on God's love. God's love is the thing I'm the surest of. But I don't presume on it. Hence my faith is not tested in many ways that would be unfortunate. I told you folks the story of keeping the death watch with a friend of mine and his girlfriend and the St. Christopher's medal she put on his pillow before the days of penicillin when he had a ruptured appendix. And she knew he was going to live and I knew he was going to die. And he died. And you see, because she didn't know and understand, She suffered so much more than she had to. I couldn't tell her he was going to die. I mean, it wasn't in my heart to tell her, but he died. And I knew he was. If we understand more, then we can have faith. We can depend on God without being presumptuous. We can have courage without... Our faith can be childlike without being childish.
Yes.
To me, childlike faith is a lovely and wonderful thing. It's trusting God as a child trusts God without any question. But a childish faith is to assume that God will do everything for you. When you fail to take inventory and say, well, gee whiz, what did you give me these hands for? And this brain, there's an awful lot of this I'm supposed to do for myself. And of course, to me, theology, philosophy, metaphysics help you draw the line between what's up to you and what you may safely put in God's hands. I put my eternal future in God's hands with no reserve whatsoever. That's up to him. Now, my temporal problem, I think he's left a good deal up to me. I don't think God cares whether I prosper or go broke. He's concerned with the status of my soul, not my bank account. I care whether I prosper or go broke. So it behooves me to do things to pay a certain amount of attention to money. Which I do. For what shall we pray? Shall I pray for prosperity?
I don't think so. Yeah. But let's thank him for what we do have.
Well, of course. Of course. Otherwise, you get into the jam. I was talking to the Jebby, and a Jesuit. And he believes, of course, if you're trying for a contract, if you pray, you're more apt to get it. I said, but suppose, Father Raymond, I said, they're both Catholic contractors, and both of them are praying. Well, he says, the one that prays the better, then. But I think it's much better to sharpen your pencil and write an awfully good proposal or do a good job of selling. I think it's much more apt to get business than prayer. What department are we in? How can we live intelligently as well as with faith? Childish faith would pray over a sick child. I think you should send for a physician. And I don't believe that the person who sends for the physician necessarily has any less faith in God. But I think that person has a better understanding of where God is functional and where God has chosen not to be functional. Childish faith confuses God's omnipotence with with the concept of omniscience. Childlike faith says, my Father is all-powerful. Childish faith says, my Father does all things. And God certainly does not do all things. If he did all things, there would be no room for free will in the whole universe. There's a great difference between the two statements. In God, all things consist, and all things consist of God. One is a statement of a belief of God's infinity. The other is a belief in pantheism, which is God is everywhere. That to me is the difference. Jesus' faith was childlike, but far from childish. When they were about to go out on a preaching tour, Jesus very practically said, what's the condition of the treasury? He was informed it was empty. He did not say, let us pray. He said, well, boys, we'll go fishing first. We'll sell our catch, and then we'll go preaching. And it worked, too. They caught fish. They sold it for money. Then they went preaching. Very practical, wasn't it? Childish faith asks for the impossible. Childlike faith can be, it's discerning, it's insight. It reckons with different spheres of activity on God's part. See, a little child depends on God or his parents for everything. And given fairly decent parents, it's not too disappointed. But then a mature adult should not only depend on God, but should also depend on himself. It's a partnership. Some things I count on for God, and other things I think God expects me to do those things. That makes sense. I understand why.
Childish faith is very helpful.
Oh, of course it is. I'd never attack it. Except it's so vulnerable to hurt. Because when you expect God to do something which he normally doesn't do, then what are you when he doesn't do it? You count it on. Yeah. Yes, you're shook too much of the time. It's as I taught my children when they grew up. I taught them, first of all, that God is omnipotent. I didn't use these fancy terms. But I said, he doesn't do everything. He could, but he's chosen not to, because he wants the rest of us to have experience. And I said, if you want something material, discuss it with me. I think he's delegated this to me. And if you want something that's not material, like courage, happiness, and kindness, then I said, discuss that with God. I can't make those gifts to you. And as far as I know, they were not disappointed in their prayers. It stands to reason, if they want an electric train, I don't think God gives a damn whether they have an electric train or not. But I do. Because I never had enough when I was a kid. It was real fun to get lots of them. When do we quit, Madam President?
If you will answer J.B.'s question, I thought that would be a nice thing to terminate the accident section.
What's
on
J.B.'s question?
He would like for you to explain the difference in, say, a plant of Yamaha Rancho and the architectural sphere in Jerusalem and on the valley, the difference in the material. And that's sort of right, J.B.
The difference between material rawness and architecture.
Well, a planet like ours is a chance and circumstance planet. Consider the origin of our planet. About 4.5 billion years ago, our sun was convulsed and semi-disrupted by the passage of a pretty massive dark island, which caused a tidal convulsion and the emission of a lot of material out of the sun. And it gradually, this material clotted and coalesced. See, gravity did cause it to clot. And our planet was one of the, was built up around one of the cores that began to form. And this is a purely evolutionary proposition. This means that our planet has got lots of unresolved stresses. We have earthquakes, we have storms, we have all kinds of disturbances here and there. This stands in contrast to an architectural world. An architectural world is put together by the intelligent action of the power directors, master physical controllers, power centers. And I think they assemble this world just like a printer sets type. They set the world together, like you assemble a font of type. They assemble molecules, atoms and whatnot, and they build this world, and they build it intelligently. So it doesn't have any stresses. It's free from storms, it's free from disturbances. It's a standard architectural world. All of the administrative worlds, Marantia, spiritual, or whatnot, are standard construction. I think they're built out of the same physical elements that we find on Urantia, except it's done rationally. It's the difference between picking out a cave to live in and building a house. A cave is a natural habitat. A house is an artificial, an architectural habitat. And it's far more suitable for living purposes. Natural worlds, inhabited planets, are always dependent on the sun. They've got to have warmth, light, heat. We live on sun energy. The vegetative life traps this sun energy and through photosynthesis uses up our carbon dioxide, liberates oxygen, builds food for us to eat. So actually it's sun energy that keeps us running. Oxygen builds food for us to eat. So actually it's sun energy that keeps us running. On an architectural world, they don't have a sun. This world is independently energized, lighted, and heated. They light this world by shooting things up to something like our heaviside layer, which reflects radio waves, and that reflects this light back down on the planet so that you have a normal diffusion of light. But there's no sun or moon. shining in the sky. They tell us that on Jerusalem, it's day, what is it, daytime for two-thirds of the time or three-quarters? Three-quarters of the time it's daylight. It's like about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then one-quarter of the time it's nighttime, sort of like a full moonlight, not completely dark. And these architectural worlds, Jerusalem would be a good example of a balance between the material, Marantia, and the spiritual. On Jerusalem and the mansion world, and similarly on Edentia, there are 100 Marantia elements. Now, I can't prove this, but I visualize the core of Jerusalem, or any one of the other 56 satellites, sub-satellites, as being completely physical, made up of material elements as we understand those elements, hydrogen, oxygen, calcium, strontium, zinc, and whatnot. It's at the surface that you have the Marantia elements. You've got two kinds of vegetation growing there. Physical vegetation with green leaves. Marantia vegetation with orchid-colored leaves. There are three gases in the atmosphere. I suppose nitrogen and oxygen plus a Marantia gas. So it's suitable for respiration with either physical lungs or Marantia lungs. All throughout the local universe, these architectural worlds will contain three types of structures: physical, Marantia, spiritual. On Jerusalem, you'll have them in perfect balance. On Edentia, less physical, more Marantia and spiritual. On Salvington, less Marantia, more spiritual. From there on up, it's still a physical world, but I think for the most part the structures are spiritual, but not all. On the minor sector worlds, you have, it's the grand rendezvous of the master physical controllers. So I'm sure that there's some physical structures up there for them. And this would be true all the way up the line.
But you think the core would be
purely physical.
We understand it.
Purely physical,
it's the
yeah.
Surface.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we couldn't see the surface.
Well, I don't know. What kind of dirt do these plants grow in? Or is it a mix?
Oh, it's more spiritual and
physical. Well, let's stick to Jerusalem. If the atmosphere is a three-gas mix, two of which are physical and one of which is Marantia, don't you suppose that the dirt that supports either physical or Marantia life would be also a mix? A mulch, maybe? So it would be real to either a physical being or to a Marantia being?
I think you're...
Yeah. Let's take a Marantia companion. I think that Marantia companion sees a real surface there. And I think there must be many places where it's a mixed deal. I certainly paved with a mixed material, which you have seen me walk. Archangel writes, I cannot with exclusive spirit vision perceive the building in which this narrative is being translated and recorded. This is the time of the writing of this paper. Sees you as you are. And at the same time, he visualizes the solitary messenger, the Supernathan, and other celestial beings present. As we move up the line, we will never lose contact with the physical world. Our expanding horizon won't close off what we've left behind. So the mighty...
Come back to it.
What?
But we don't come back to it.
No, but if we encounter physical reality, we know, we see it.
if we're, let's say there's a commission, well, this revelatory commission, when it was here, there's a gorgeous sunset. The mighty messenger sees that sunset in all its flaming glory. The divine counselor has to have it explained to him.
Visions are thereby extended.
Right. Yes, we advance, but we don't retreat.
Well, the thing I was wondering, you know, it says all architectural spheres are physical.
Yes. I think the core is physical. Uniformly
that's,
physical.
That's the thing.
It's at the surface that you have diversity mm-hmm. of things. But then that would be true here, too. If you stop and reckon, at noon today, the roll call of planetary angels, that's here, guardians and others on Urantia, was 501,234,619 pairs of seraphim. I think there are spiritual structures here on Urantia. You stop and figure, we got over 1 billion seraphim here on this world. And we've got about the same number of cherubim as seraphim, so this runs about 2 billion spiritual beings. Only 25% of the cherubim would be Meranti cherubim. So when you have roughly a quarter of 1 million Meranti cherubim and 1.75 million spirit ministers, I'll bet you there's lots of spiritual structures here on this planet where they live. Absolutely.
Out of our realm, completely.
Completely beyond our perception.
Because we're not endowed with that type of vision.
Right. Consider what a solitary messenger would perceive of what we perceive. A solitary messenger would know that there was a planet here because he registers gravity. He would know that this planet was inhabited by injuster indwelt beings, because while the solitary messenger does not perceive us, the solitary messenger registers the presence of an adjuster. And he'd know that we were there if the adjuster was there. So I kind of try to figure, what would a solitary messenger see approaching a planet? He would see an irregular shaped globe lit by fireflies, the outline of the globe being indicated by the fireflies, the sparks of the adjusters. And then he would register a certain gravity presence. And this is how he would know that this was an inhabited world, adjuster indwelt. Yeah. He wouldn't see the world. He would sense the mass of the world through the gravity force. And he would perceive the globe of the world, because the fireflies would be distributed unequally in the shape of a globe. More in some places than others, depending on population. He'd know there was a city, because the fireflies would clot, see? When there were millions of fireflies in one place, you'd know this was a big city by human standards.
And he could talk to a mighty messenger who would tell him about the rest of it. It's interesting that the only thing in us that would be real to that solitary messenger would be the thought of Chester.
Well, the mighty messenger could see it all.
The whole thing, yes.
And all the celestial beings around also.
Sure. He'd see the solitary messenger and he'd see us. He could tell if we needed a shave or a haircut.
The seraphims and the cherubims and all others. He could really see a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, a Marantia cherubim could see a good deal of this. So could a fourth creature of the Conciliating Commission. They register physical reality. A Havona servital would register physical reality, I think. The fourth creature of the servital. So there's always these connecting links between the physical and the spiritual. Because I'm pretty sure that the fourth creature of the conciliators can see physical things and also spiritual things. Should we give up for the second here? I can't.
I'm glad we're approached there.
Yeah. I sure am glad I'm helpless. What is your pleasure? Outside of Burke that we talk about. Because I'd rather save that topic for later on in life when I'm more mature. And I better feel better confident to cope. Cockroach is always on the verge of saying something.
Dion, what's an arcade?
Golly. Well, they're bigger than that. They're the largest number of high orders, the most plentiful high spirit beings in a local universe. And I better look at what the book says. I don't know that I've read any. Plenty. Yeah, I kind of like the difference between a corporal and a lieutenant colonel. Archangels are the highest type of high spirit being produced in large numbers in the local universe. At the last registry, there were almost 800,000 in Nebadon. Now, angels number up in the billions. We just were checking, remember, this afternoon. There are over a billion seraphim here on this planet. And if there are 3.5 million planets, then that should indicate that there would be on planetary duty, my heavens, how does that give me, let's see, this is 3.5 million multiplied by a billion. Let's see, that takes 9 more zeros. 1, 2, 3. That's millions, billions, trillions, quadrillions. There'd be 3.5 quadrillion seraphim. Just figuring it from planetary duty alone. That figures no angels anywhere except on the planet.
How many do you have there?
3.5 quadrillion.
Yeah.
or 3,500 trillion, or 3.5 million billions of seraphim, in contrast to 800,000 archangels. That's part of the difference.
Still, they're bounded if they're
on the planet. Yeah. Now, I'd say you could double that number of seraphim and be pretty safe. I figure seraphim are the second most numerous inhabitants of a local universe. They'd be outnumbered only by mortals, which I think are probably the most numerous. Archangels are too much what they do. They work with the bestowal sons, like the magisterial sons. They command seraphic groups. They are concerned with personality identification. I think before we die down here, the archangels take a personality stenciling. They thumbprint our personality, so that when we wake up there, they can certify it's the same personality. Because no one knows where the personality goes in between death and resurrection. That's an unsolved mystery. The soul, the seraphim has. But the archangel is not the custodian of the personality, merely the identifier of the return of the personality. And beyond that, I don't know what they do.
They have a headquarters.
Yeah. They have a divisional headquarters here.
Okay, records of
personality? Ma'am, yes. They do. Now, let me point out something to you that is intriguing. The Salvington, our local universe capital, is encircled by different groups of worlds. And just so I don't misquote myself, I'll check and just get how many of these there are. The Salvington circuit is made up of 70 primary spheres, each of which is encircled by 6 tributary spheres devoted to specialized activities. These marvelous spheres, 70 primaries and 420 tributaries, are often spoken of as the Melchizedek University. There are 490 worlds altogether. They are grouped in 10 groups, so that there would be 49 worlds in each group. Now, the seraphim have one group of worlds assigned to them. Assigned to 7,000 trillions of beings. The archangels have a group of worlds assigned to them. 49 worlds assigned to 800,000 beings. There's a catch here somewhere, isn't there? There are a lot of people on the archangel world that we don't know anything about, don't you think? Sure it is. Same thing applies to the brilliant evening stars. When you figure out all the different places that brilliant evening stars have to be, there are enough of them to go around. And the papers say the brilliant evening stars are their coordinates. They're the principal deputies of Gabriel. Now, if one group of 49 Salvington worlds is assigned to more than 7,000 trillion beings, and another group is assigned to only 800,000, most of whom must be out on duty, this should suggest to you how many folks we don't know anything about in the local universe. There's one question I'm going to ask tomorrow night, and that is, to what group of beings is the 10th group of Salvington worlds assigned?
I'm going to ask that question tomorrow night.
To what group of beings is the 10th what?
Group of Salvation Worlds assigned. I think it's fair to announce the question in advance, isn't it?
Sure, you want
to stay out all night, all day tomorrow looking it up. Well, you know, these groups are assigned to the Melchizedek, the Barabbadex, the Lenonadex, the Life Carriers, Spirit-Fused Mortals, Synalogers, Archangels, Seraphim.
But I think we tried to hook that up one night, but couldn't.
There are 10 groups of worlds around Salvington. I want to know which, to what group of personalities is the 10th group of Salvington worlds assigned. That's fair to.
But they omit that one, don't they?
I know some do.
No, sir, I bet it's in there, and it's one of those little things tucked away in the corner that Bill has found that he's going to do that.
As I recall, when we went through there, we looked for that, and you kind of go on by it before you realize it's.
Did you have a question in there?
Oh, I was just going to suggest that you tell us some more questions you're going to ask tomorrow.
Well, who is the angels of the churches?
They're seraphim who have made the paradise ascent as seraphim. They are the peers of finalizers. They're eternity seraphim. They're Seraphington graduates. And they've come back here to serve in their local universe. Seraphim like that are never going to default any more than a finaliter would. And they're the seraphim. Among other things, they are charged with planetary government. And they man the cabinet post in the government of a planet. I would assume if we had a planetary prince that these same functions would be discharged on the planet. And if you'll recall, swing at the end of part three. Cabinet jobs, epical progress, religious guardians, nation life, races, future, enlightenment, health, home, industry, diversion, and superhuman ministry. That's how they run this world. You see, seraphim are created way below seraphim. When they make the paradise ascent and become the equivalent of a finaliter, they close the gap. They then are the coordinates of seraphim. But they're still seraphim, only their completion seraphim, members of the seraphic corps of completion. They have, as seraphim, done the equivalent of what a mortal does when he becomes a finality.
Well, they probably have implanted his blood, too.
Sir?
They'll implant
his blood. Oh, sure they will. The two groups, I think, that are primarily concerned with this book are the second and third. The progress angels and the religious guardians, the Prometheans and the Epimetheans. I think the progress angels are Promethean, the religious guardians are Epimethean. And they're engaged in a perpetual tug of war. And if either side won, it would be fatal. They need to be in perpetual protagonistic cooperation, antagonistic cooperation.
Well, then the Prometheans must have the ball now.
I think so.
Yeah.
Later on, 500 years, it either becomes Epimethean or it dies.
That's right.
It may not be 500 years. Well, that's one guess good as another. What's the difference?
Are you eating or are you digesting?
Yeah.
If you're eating, you're Promethean. If you're digesting, you're Epimethean. And you need to do both. That's the main difference I can see when you make between seraphim and archangels. There's an awful lot more seraphim than there are archangels. And they function in quite a different way. But I don't think we know much about archangels. And I'm sure that they don't use up 49 worlds. Because if you divide 800,000 by... if you divide 50 into there, that's the same as 5 into 80,000. And that goes in about 16 times 16,000. You'd only have 16,000 archangels on each world, roughly, or 17,000, if they were all there. And most of them must be out on duty. No, it doesn't. Which means there's other things going on there. And the archangels merely symbolize who those worlds are assigned to. There's an awful lot left out here. And they warn us of that. They say, when they've said all they have to say about local universe personalities, they say there are still other types of intelligent beings concerned with the administration of a local universe. But the plan of this narrative does not provide for the further revelation of these orders of creation. Enough of the life and administration of this universe is being herewith portrayed to afford the mortal mind a grasp of the reality and grandeur of the survival existence. Further experience in your advancing careers will increasingly reveal these interesting and charming beings. This narrative cannot be more than a brief outline of the nature and work of the manifold personalities who throng the universes of space, administering these creations as enormous training schools, schools wherein the pilgrims of time advance from life to life and world to world, until they are lovingly dispatched from the borders of the universe of their origin to the higher educational regime of the super universe, and thence on to the training, to the spirit training worlds of Avona, and eventually to paradise and the high destiny of the finaliters, the eternal assignment on missions not yet revealed in the universes of time and space. And incidentally, Minnie Mae, all these angels we've been talking about are only 1/7 of the total. Remember? Because 6 out of 7 angels are unrevealed. They have nothing to do with a mortal career. Yeah. That's a lot of angels in the local universe. Just a real lot of...
Well,
consider how poorly we do without them.
Well, I know, that's true. But
yeah.
All the way out
here. We have no basis for comparison.
I think it's surprising that we aren't better.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. Well, Frankie, you underestimate the desperate fight in human nature, I think. You don't realize how really mean we are.
Yes, I do. I don't know. I feel like.
I am like you. You didn't ride the boat.
How near we are. I guess
that's what comes to me. Looking at the animals. Well, we're blood kin to the animal world. There's no question. If you had any doubts, comparative anatomy would resolve those rather quickly.
We're too similar. We're structured too much the same.
We're just two adjectives above them.
More than that. Two adjectives, one Holy Spirit, one Spirit of Truth, one personality, one thought of justice. You see, the people who fought evolution had something on their side. While biologically it's a small step, that one small step triggers a tremendous number of changes. Worship, wisdom, Holy Spirit, Spirit of Truth, thought of justice, personality separate man from the higher. So the gap is a tremendous gap between the lowest type of human mind and the highest type of mammalian mind. What is the lowest type of human mind? Republican or Democrat?
Well, I can answer that real quick.
I can too,
but I probably won't.
That's the gap of the midway or the morning.
Huh? What does the mind... Their mind, we're trying to coordinate spiritual and physical things. What would the animal mind do?
That's a good question.
I think, as our mind attempts to coordinate material and spiritual aspects, what would the mind of an animal do comparatively?
I just think it just would be burned. keep the organism fed, gratify the sex drive, and stay alive.
But you couldn't say they had no type of intelligence.
Oh no, they're intelligent.
Because they do.
Animals think, but they don't think on a spiritual or moral level.
But they are devoted.
Yeah.
Devoted to survival.
Yes. Animals have capacity for some affection. But I think we read into the animal a lot more personality than is there.
Right.
We invest the animal with more than the animal has. Because we're persons, and we project that into the animal.
But their intelligence sometimes is amazing.
Yes.
They
use
an intuition.
They don't
know
when to go
count.
Yeah.
Look, well, some qualities about the human mind seemingly has lost some qualities to evolution.
Yes, and it's because it's become more adaptable. You see, the more specialized you are, the less adaptative you are. The shark is particularly well specialized to swim and feed in the water, and that's all the shark can do. Man is not a good competitor with any animal in that animal's particular environment. But man can dominate the whole Kashmir because he's not specialized. Man is a very generalized type of animal. Hence does pretty well in all types of environments and achieves his own specialization through building tools, through fire, through weapons. Man and gorilla are a bad contest. The gorilla's gonna win. But pretty soon you give a man a spear, an axe, then a gun, and pretty soon the gorilla's hopelessly outclassed. The animal knows, but it's not aware of the fact. Man knows and knows that he knows. I strongly suspect that this is one of the functions of personality in relation to mind. I think personality has a mirror-like quality to mind. It is something before which mind can stand and see itself, which is to say, become aware of consciousness. To be self-conscious.
So you're on this side of the mirror.
Yeah.
So
I'm saying I let the personality be the mirror in front of which man can, mind can stand and see mind. I know, and I am well aware of the fact that I know. I know that I know. The dog knows, but I don't think he is aware of that fact. He accepts consciousness without inquiry. I make inquiry into consciousness. That's second degree consciousness. Consciousness of consciousness. This is the foundation, I think, of moral insight, which no animal has. Man has prevision. Animals do not. Animals choose means to achieve an end. Man can do this also. But man also can stand off and say, I wonder, do I want to achieve this objective? Man discriminates ends as well as means, which means that man's thinking transcends time in part. Man can project himself ahead and consider rewards and consequences of a given act. And without this, he couldn't make a moral choice. Animals choose, but that choosing is submoral. Man chooses, and that choosing is moral. Or immoral. But how could you be immoral if you weren't moral?
I'd like to have a definition of mind. I know I got kind of confused when I was doing it. I took psychology.
You wound up more confused.
First thing that he said was that there is no such thing as mind. And that they just kind of left everybody in a lurch. Actually, what he meant, I think, was that in that it was an intangible object that didn't exist. But he never did give it. Gives me a substitute for thinking power, a reason. He just called a reason. A reasoning.
Well, he said there was no mind, but he didn't tell you how we thought, did he?
No.
Without mind. So let's go back and erase that and say there is mind. Since he makes a statement that he can't back up, he says that there's no mind because he can't quantify it. He can't weigh it or measure it and say how many grams of mind we have. And yet you can measure the differential effects of mind by giving power tests to people. Mind, as I view it, think of a clothesline. Put a loop in the clothesline. Don't tie a knot there. Just a loop. That loop symbolizes your mind. The clothesline is the seven-adjutant circuit. That loop is maintained by your living cerebral cortex, the living brain. Maintains that loop. As long as your brain is alive, that individualized portion of seven-adjutant mind is yours. It's an individualization of the circuit of the adjutant. When you die, they just straighten out the clothesline, the loop is gone. And you leave this mind level behind you. Mind. When you have mind, it means that you are the recipient of living ministry. Somebody is ministering mind to you. You don't mix your own drinks on the mind level. The local universe mother spirit is the bartender who serves us mind. It's a seven-level pousse café, you know, all the way from intuition to wisdom. As long as you live, that loop is there, and you use it. When you die, you leave this mind behind you. Now, what do you take with you? You take with you the results of using mind, which is character. How do you take the character with you in the soul? Your personality is not changed by what you do, but your soul is. And your soul carries the harvest of all the thinking, choosing, deciding, living, doing, and what have you of this life. The adjuster carries the spiritual transcript of that harvest, which is apart from the whole harvest, only that which has spiritual meaning. There is much in the soul that the adjusters cannot counter for. Because, well, take all moral decisions. They're not spiritual. They're pre-spiritual, super-animal, but sub-spiritual. Much memory. The adjuster has to transgress, but it's in the soul and can be resurrected. Then when you get up to the first mansion world in the resurrection hall, they take a new clothesline, the better clothesline, the nylon line, the better mind, and they loop that around, a new living cortex, and that's how you think. You're encircuited always with mind. Does that answer your question?
Bill, that'll fit consciousness into that.
Consciousness, I think, or we're in trouble now. I want to relate consciousness to the presence of personality. But you're going to immediately say, how is an animal conscious? The return of consciousness on the mansion world, I think, takes place when your personality seizes control of this mind circuit. Your personality, which comes from no one knows where, but it shows up at the right time, and no one knows where it's been. When I try to think of the mechanics of human consciousness, I visualize, we've used this illustration before. Have you been in a planetarium?
Yeah.
All right, can you visualize a double dome planetarium, one underneath as well as one above, two hemispheres? Right in the center of this sphere is a platform. And on that platform, there's a searchlight. It's got a little up and down traverse, a few degrees, and it's got a 360-degree swing. It illuminates roughly the equatorial region of the interior of this globe. And wherever this searchlight hits, that is your consciousness at this given moment.
That will only vary so many degrees
right.
From the equator up or down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But now I want to think about the second Nicaraguan campaign. And I got my consciousness over here now. I'm remembering Leon. And the night we shot up the town on the 4th of July. And the next morning all the natives were in camp because they thought the revolution had hit. And it all started because one staff sergeant got crocked. And at 1 minute after 12, on the night of the 3rd, he pulled out his 45 and let fly in the air. We celebrated independence. Now I'm back here, see. If I phone my searchlight, back. When you wake up, it turns on again. The nether hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, the nether hemisphere is the subconscious mind. And it gets pretty darn mammalian. And there's a pretty sewer-like seepage that comes up from the bottom. Or do you remember your dream? The upper hemisphere, I think, is leading into the superconscious mind. The paper suggests if we postulate a subconscious, we might be consistent, postulate a superconscious. The two together constituting the unconscious part of mind. I think as you go down towards the mammalian level of mind, and the lower adjutants are down there, in the upper hemisphere, I think you're moving towards spirit. I think the soul lives in the polar region of this hemisphere. and the adjuster is tangent to the North Pole. Now, this is a very crude symbol, but I find it a very satisfactory symbol of mine. And just as much as much sewage wells up from the bottom, much truth seeps down from top side. There's a continuous seepage both ways into the zone of consciousness, which is the internal equator, the torrid zone. This is the picture I have in mind. It's very crude, but very satisfying.
Boy, it's terrific.
Very good.
Yes,
ma'am.
Does it have to do with water?
No. You say that the spirit, the spirit is part of our life, goes with your gesture.
Yes. I think the ugliness is just the soul. Let's add another category. Inconsequential thoughts. For example, all the motor memory I have of dressing, which enables me to get dressed without thinking much about it. Now, this I don't think is this. How to drive a car. Very bad set of reflexes as well. But strictly speaking, I think much of the trivia of life will pass away with the death of the cortex. I think much, everything of importance, I think, persists in the soul. Everything of spiritual significance is duplicated in the adjustment. Now, let's reunite all this information. Whatever the adjuster has counterparted becomes active memory immediately to you. But that's only a part of what's in the soul. The remainder has to be awakened through your being told about it. By your guardian seraphim, by a fellow survivor, in lots of ways. So that finally, all of the non-adjuster counterparted memory in the soul is activated and becomes active memory. And once activated, you never lose it. Consider a spirit who is assessed. He has no adjuster. All of his memory is dormant. When he wakes up on the first mansion world, as far as he can tell, he is a brand new being. He has no active memory of his previous state. But little by little, he recaptures his memory. And little by little, he resurrects his memory of who he was and where he came from. We part
by what method.
Does he remember the bad part?
I'm sure he does. I'm sure. If there's any spiritual good to be gained from memory, remember the bad? Certainly. I don't think any of us remember the truth. Like how to tie shoelaces. Yes.